Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Big blue skulls, purple shawls, big blue bulls, big blue bulls. Let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome to The Henson Perspective, where we revisit an episode of The Muppet Show on its 45th anniversary of its original New York air date. Today, we're talking about the Elton John episode, which was originally broadcast on February 6th, 1978, after having been originally recorded between October 25th and 27th of 1977. This is production episode 214. I'm going to say that up front because there are going to be one or two things that are going to be callbacks or references to other production episodes, and so it'll be good for people to be aware of where this fits in the production timeline. Otherwise, I ended last episode off mic by telling you that this was one of the funniest episodes that I remember watching back in the day. And upon revisiting it, I have strong guesses as to how you're going to ultimately rate this when we get to the end and you rate the guest star. Like the Rudolph Nureyev episode, I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the guest and the overall episode. So I'm looking forward to getting into talking about it.
Yeah, not to telegraph anything, but previously my rating system has been interesting, and I came to that realization with this episode where the guest is just doing their thing, and how I'm very critical of that with comedians. But it dawned on me with this episode with musicians, like, he does some sketch. Not a lot, though. It's basically just three songs of his.
But I would say that in the past, we've talked about, and you have dinged people in the past for, I'm thinking specifically of the Teresa Brewer episode, where she just did stuff from her repertoire and that wasn't even reflective of where she was as a musician in that stage in her career.
Sure.
And you sort of said, I can't rate her that highly because she's not showing us her range. She's just doing
the hits.
Yeah. So when we eventually get around to talking about the Elton John segments in this, I wouldn't at all be surprised if that same kind of criticism comes up. Because it's great for a musician to come in and say, I'm going to do other than just my act.
Mm-hmm.
But for them to treat this like Top of the Pops and they're just doing their bangers, I'd say it's fair, if that's what you've criticized comedians for, to criticize a musician for doing that.
Yep. Yep.
Well, before we get to talking about Elton John.
Very true.
There is a runner in this episode that we want to go through in terms of talking about its connective tissue. Once we're done with that, we will cycle back to the trivia portion that will then allow us to talk about the Elton John segments and any other segments that are disconnected to either of those two running themes.
The running theme in this episode is Swedish Chef-centered. So we're going to talk about every Swedish Chef segment of the show first and as a whole, and then we'll cycle back. Because in the very first backstage segment,
Kermit has just welcomed the participants in the previous sketch from backstage in that continuity way in which you get a little bit of talk from the people exiting the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's juggling the people coming from stage, he's also prepping the Swedish Chef to go on stage.
Yeah, he calls for Scooter, but Swedish Chef appears. And then Kermit tells him he's on next and then continues looking for Scooter.
Pete.
Yes.
Jim Henson is the voice of the Swedish Chef. Isn't that correct?
I believe so, yes.
So we have Kermit talking to the Swedish Chef in this segment in what I think is a really good bit, in that the Swedish Chef is talking in his nonsensical Swedish, and every time he says something, Kermit says, yeah, I know. And then once the Swedish Chef finally passes him, he looks directly to camera in one of two or three direct-to-camera moments. We haven't had these in a little bit.
Nope.
To say,
I know. I don't know.
It was only that it got me to suddenly realize I don't think Jim is switching between doing both voices, so he must be working with the recording. And so therefore the timing of that is pretty good.
And who's
puppeteering
him? Yeah, who's puppeteering who?
Well,
it's got to be Jim's hands.
No, it's never been Jim's hands. It's always been Frank's hands.
That's right. It's the improv game.
And so I assume, I mean, I didn't look too closely at the veins and knuckles of the hands to see whether or not, but I'm assuming that therefore Frank was doing the hands and whether somebody else was doing the head, because I think there are still two, I think we see both human hands.
I believe so, yeah.
You probably could have done it with one human hand and Frank doing the head, or maybe the puppet is impossible to maneuver that way, that you would have just had a dangling sleeve and the lack of shoulder would have revealed itself.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Jim is also Waldorf, and we'll get into it later, but Swedish Chef appears while Waldorf is on screen as well.
So we've got a lot of behind-the-scenes technical problems of solving Jim working with Jim.
But the fandom page does not do anything to shed any light as to how this worked.
Once the Swedish Chef has passed by Kermit and gone on stage, Kermit, as you said, was looking for Scooter earlier, continues to look for Scooter, and bumps into the piano that Scooter is pushing.
See, I wrote it as he got hit by the piano.
Oh, did you?
It is as if Kermit was a pedestrian and the piano was a car. And in that same situation, you'd say Kermit got hit by a car.
Yep. Even if a pedestrian walked into traffic and therefore his vector collided with the other vector, you would still say the thing that was bigger and more massive
hit him. So there's a hit.
Kermit, surprised, asks what Scooter is doing with the piano. Scooter replies that he has a song that he really wants to play for Elton John.
Kermit almost begs him not to do that. But Scooter once again plays the uncle card and says, gee, my uncle who owns the theater really wanted him to hear it. Kermit changes his tune and decides to help him push the piano up the stairs.
Which we do not see.
No.
That could have been a backstage runner. They could have done a whole bit of just trying to get that piano upstairs.
Yeah.
But instead, they push it off screen, nowhere towards the stairs.
Maybe there's an elevator in there. Maybe the rundown theater is ADA compliant.
But dispensing with all of that possibility, we then cut to the Swedish Chef on stage, where he has in front of him a chicken in a laying box. He sings his introduction song with the chicken looking pretty pleased to be there, and with him caressing the wattles on the side of the chicken's head as he sings the intro.
Yeah, he's trying to coax an eggy from the cheeky.
Because he wants to make egg du chef.
Egg of the chef, I assume?
Yeah. When the chicken concentrates and lays for the chef, the chef produces a small white orb, which he's momentarily confused by, and after shaking some salt on it, decides instead to test out its veracity by chucking it at the countertop, at which point it bounces, and he says, this is not an egg, this is a ping pong ball.
Not in those exact words.
It's for the egg, the ping pong ball. It's for the mega board. It's for the egg.
After the first ping pong ball, the chef hits the chicken twice. Out of anger that he produced a ping pong ball, or she produced a ping pong ball instead of an egg. Then, after being hit, the chicken concentrates once again, and this time lays multiple ping pong balls.
This is actually the heart of this segment of the sketch, is we've talked before about one of the things that the games that the Swedish Chef's sketches play is that there is no discernible language. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it's the chef by himself, but when he's interacting with something else, whether it be a foodstuff or an invader, they often either speak in nonsense or speak another foreign language. And so that there's just this cavalcade of syllables on screen that nobody can really understand.
Mm-hmm.
While I love, for example, the lobster sketch, one of my biggest problems with it is that they feel the need to occasionally have the lobsterita just speak in English in order to convey the action, which I consider to be a crutch. You should have nothing comprehensible going on in that.
Mm-hmm.
Even un egg de ping pong ball is, you know, getting real close.
See, I like the occasional English thrown in there.
Yeah. But therefore, the heart of this sketch is actually just the chicken making laying noises.
Yes.
And so that's what we get, is a further extension of having laid the first egg, the chicken is then concentrating, stretching, squawking even more in order to produce these two at once.
And then upon realizing that he produced two more eggs, the Swedish Chef hits the chicken three more times.
Because these are not eggs. These are also ping pong balls.
Correct.
He bounces them off the counter and then says, you know what? In his fake Swedish, he says, we're no longer going to do egg du chef. We're now going to do chicky du chef. And switches out his tiny fry pan for the eggs for a giant metal skillet with which to fry some chicken.
Yep, and beat the chicken over the head with.
The chicken jumps out of the box, and the two of them chase each other around the kitchen island in the middle of the set.
Ben, chickens say bok. They don't, it's not a bok.
You want to try that again with plural?
No, because it
chickens
falls apart.
Say box.
Yeah, that's all.
There's a brief moment where after a couple of revolutions around the island, the chicken is breathless, and in order to try and pacify her, the Swedish chef pretends to strum the pan like it's a ukulele or guitar.
Yeah.
And then quickly switches back to it being an implement of mass incapacitation that he's going to smack the chicken up with.
It's a fun visual gag, but I also don't understand why the Swedish chef would give up his opportunity to get the chicken.
Yeah, the timing of it isn't great. He should have been strumming, and then the chicken took a break, because it's okay for it to stop now that he no longer is using the pan.
Right, exactly.
This culminates with the sound continues while it cuts to the Statler and Waldorf in the booth.
Yeah, you can still hear them chasing.
So it doesn't rise to a conclusion or like a squawk that indicates the end of the sketch. It's just still going on while Statler and Waldorf, I believe it's Waldorf, suggests.
Hey, let's sneak out and have a pizza.
Because this clearly is going to keep going for a while. And guess what? As we said, it's our runner of the episode, so it keeps going.
Which I just wanted to say, I didn't get that. I didn't get that there was no real end to the sketch until I was rewatching this and I realized that's deliberate for them to give us the audio impression that there is no conclusion for this.
Yeah, it's a very subtle subliminal message to us. Because, I also, even upon rewatching it, was like, that's a weird choice. Mm. But it's not. It's not a weird choice. It's a very deliberate choice. The next time we see the Swedish chef and the chicken is when Scooter is introducing Elton John. Scooter's wearing a cool jacket, and as he starts introducing, the chicken and Swedish chef re-enter, and the Swedish chef has a cleaver now instead of the skillet, and he's chasing the chicken. They very quickly run off stage, and then Scooter introduces the guest star in a very understated way. Here he is, the greatest talent in the history of the universe, Elton John.
We will get back to the greatest talent in the history of the universe during the second third of the program, but the next time the Swedish chef and the chicken show up is as the punchline to our next sketch. So we are blowing this by talking about this as part of the runner. I apologize, unless, of course, you've already watched the episode.
Which you should have.
Because it is the climax of the action in the Pigs in Space sketch. The intangible, the redoubtable, and the sanctimonious cast are introduced, and the voiceover tells us that there's been a fearful attack of boredom on the Swine Track.
All three of them are just sort of lazily staring off into distances, looking bored and sighing repeatedly. Since I'm all about timing and numbers, I forget who says it. I think it's Strange Pork says that they blasted off 20 minutes ago.
Yes.
And that is said 19 minutes and 30 seconds into the episode.
Wow. That's not bad at all.
Yeah, I'm pretty pleased with that.
I have to assume that's a coincidence. But if it's not, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I had to mention it. As soon as they said time, I was like, well, I have to see. Even though I'm very critical on them being more than 2 seconds off on the cold open timing, within 30 seconds of that
deep
it
into the
seems
episode.
Very impressive.
As they're talking about the fact that Link wishes that they'd at least brought a TV set so he could watch his shows while he's being bored, and Piggy is criticizing him for crying at the sad parts of bowling, which is a good neg.
I also don't understand what the sad part of bowling is.
Pete, the sad part of televised bowling is all of it.
No. It's so good.
Every sad, out-of-shape, middle-aged man that has ever been on Sunday afternoon candlepin bowling is sad.
Ben, and I quote, "Do you know who I am? I am." One of the greatest quotes from a bowler of all time when he won a championship and he, in his exultation, just goes, You don't know who I am. I am.
Makes no sense, and I love it.
Yeah, sad.
No, great. So happy.
It's fearful.
Listen, I get that you could consider it boring, which goes along with this segment. I don't get how you could see it as sad.
It's depressing, therefore sad.
You don't cry at depressing.
No, it's true. I don't cry at depressing, but I do weep.
But Link very clearly loves it. But he wouldn't cry at it if he enjoys it that much. He's not watching it because it's sad. Piggy thinks it's sad.
Yes, and it is. That he likes it and enjoys it.
But he wouldn't cry if he enjoyed it.
We're going to move swiftly on from this stalemate.
Let's stay here forever.
Because we want to recreate the boring experience for our listening audience.
Exactly.
A red light goes off on the dashboard, and Piggy asks Strangeport what the red light means. He makes his second joke of the episode.
Which is almost a taxi joke, years before Taxi was on the air. Also, Ben, did you notice what the caption said for the red light?
No. Oh, wait, yes, I did. The red light buzzes at the time, and when it goes on, it goes...
Doctor, what does that red light mean?
Oh, the red light means stop, the green light means go, the yellow light...
No.
And the captions say...
Oinking noise.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like oinking to me.
The fact that that was on both Disney Plus and the DVDs means that there has to be a production note someplace, that that's what they thought they were trying to accomplish. Is that the buzzers and sound effects on the Swine Trek are pig themed.
Which would have been so good if every time that door hydraulically slides open, it was a... Yep. Would have been so good. I would have loved... I already like Pigs in Space. I would have loved Pigs in Space if that's what happened every time. But yeah, did not hear oinking noise out of those buzzes.
The red light indicates that there is an alien life form that has invaded the Swine Trek. They all consider this to be boring for a beat, and then they realize they're in danger. Swine Pork, that's not it. Strange Pork gets on the sensor array to find out what has invaded, and the punchline that we spoiled for you at the beginning of this is that there are two invaders on the spacecraft. One is...
But before it's revealed,
we
learn that Hogthrob is terrified of snakes, rightfully so, because he's very concerned that they're snakes.
Yes.
They are not snakes.
One is frightened and has feathers, and the other is speaking in some strange Scandinavian tongue. And that's when the door opens, because once you get to Scandinavian, we're pretty sure the game has been given away. The doors oink open, and and the chicken and the Swedish chef run around the studio for a minute while everybody shrieks and wails and yells.
But after the Swedish chef chases the chicken out of the shot and they leave, they very quickly go back to being bored.
And they repeat themselves, they sigh, and then it zooms to the window.
As the announcer says, tune in next week and be bored again by Pigs in Space. And then we immediately get more of the runner.
It is backstage, and the chicken is chasing the chef now off of being on stage into the backstage, and the chicken now has the meat cleaver. It takes a second to chop at the desk that Kermit is working at before running on.
Which we've established is hitting the desk.
You're really clocking up stats pretty early in this episode.
Yep.
Although I suppose this is after the ad break, technically.
I will not reveal which number this is.
And that is the only part of that runner that's in that backstage bit, so we'll come back to the rest of it later.
Okay.
And the final time that this happens is in the post-credit sequence with Statler and Waldorf at the very end of the show.
It's a different angle for the box, or for the end credits, and they're wearing specific outfits, which we will talk about later. And Statler says, well, what did you think?
And before Waldorf has a chance to reply, the chicken chases the chef through the box, and they all are circling around in the background while Waldorf then finally says, I hate running gags. Hey, Pete.
Yep.
Have Statler and Waldorf commented on running gags previously?
They have. I don't know when, but I know they have.
I did a search of transcripts through the fandom site, and there are three prior references to running gags on the show.
The first is in the Rita Moreno episode, mm-hmm. where Fozzie calls out the phone that produces different things as being a running gag.
I do remember that.
Well, Kermit actually says that it's a running gag, and then the newsman hustles past them, and Fozzie goes, no, that's a running gag. In the Candace Bergen episode, the runner in that is Fozzie delivering different telegrams or messages to Kermit the Frog. And he says he has a wire for Kermit the Frog and then hangs a coat hanger on Kermit's face and turns to the camera and says that he loves a running gag. But the only time that Statler and Waldorf have specifically commented on a running gag is in the Kay Ballard episode, where there's a furry guy who goes in to get a haircut That's on right. stage. And in order to have time pass in that, during the second cut to Statler and Waldorf up in the box, one of them says, I have a feeling this is a running gag. Mm-hmm. So they don't say whether or not they like running gags, except for the fact that in general they're critical of everything that happens on The Muppet Show. So,
except for the occasional guest.
So I would say that is implicitly a negative comment.
Which makes sense with earlier in the episode when they decide to sneak out to get pizza while it's happening the very first time.
Mm. That they would want to get away from it as quickly and as deliciously as possible.
Mm.
Anything that we want to say specifically about this as a runner? Its success, its ratio, the fact that it's a Swedish Chef runner as opposed to specifically a backstage runner?
Yeah, it was weird. I instinctively logged runner on backstage one because it's always where the runner goes. And it does because of the intro to the Swedish Chef. But otherwise, yeah, there's no real backstage.
No, the backstageness is pretty much linked to the guest star.
Yeah.
And so this is what would be a C plot, because the B plot is intertwined with...
But the B plot is still barely there. And
right.
So it's really guest segments and two C plots.
Mm.
And then things that are just unconnected to anything. So before we cycle back to the beginning and talk about the rest of this episode, including Elton John, I have some questions for you about Elton John.
Have at it.
Question number one. Elton John is not his birth name, but started using the name in 1967 and later had it legally changed. Reginald Kenneth Dwight is the name he was given by his parents. Unlike how it was depicted in the film Rocket Man, he did not get the last name of John from seeing a picture of John Lennon hung in his manager's office. Elton was the name of the saxophonist from his first band, Bluesology, whose name was Elton Dean, and he got John from the vocalist of the same band, Long John Baldry. But Elton John's full legal name is Elton Hercules John. Where did Hercules come from? A. The Greek god. B. The first appearance of the Marvel character 2 years prior, 1965. Or C. The name of the horse from the 1962 show Steptoe and Sons.
C.
Yeah, obviously that's the right answer. But it was still too wild to not include that Elton Hercules John named himself that after a horse.
I love that. That is a perfect piece of trivia. I hope that all of our listeners file that away for every useful occasion.
Ben, I told you that I did more quantity of research for this episode than I have for any others. And I think you're about to figure out why, for sure.
Okay.
In the film Rocket Man,
I was wondering,
The Muppet Show is not directly referenced. However, we do see one of the outfits that Elton John wears in this episode in a different key scene. Which outfit is featured? A. The outfit from Benny and the Jets. B. The outfit from Crocodile Rock. Or C. The outfit from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Crocodile Rock.
Also correct. There is a scene in which Elton John is having a discussion because, according to the movie and many trivia things, Elton John and his partner...
Bernie Taupin?
Yep. I just blanked on Bernie. I wanted to call Benny so badly.
Bernie and the Jets.
Exactly. Have never had an argument in their...
collective professional relationship?
Correct. Or personal. They've never argued, even though Rocket Man displays them having some tension and therefore arguments. But they say three times throughout the movie, we've never argued. And in the end credits, there's a card in the credits that say they've still never argued to this day.
Yeah, have they? But it's part of the Elton John, Bernie Taupin myth.
Yes.
And reputation.
And so there's a scene with them not arguing before a show, and Elton is wearing the peacock outfit.
Fun.
Question number three. Which of the following bands that are in the top five of Pete's most seen live bands does a cover of Elton John's Rocket Man? Is it A, Boy Sets Fire, B, Coheed and Cambria, or C, Jimmy Eat World?
C.
Incorrect. Ben, I told you I have a prop this episode. This is a 7-inch record.
Boy Sets Fire, the title seems to be Sucker Punch Training, and the B-side is Rocket Man.
Yes, I've never seen them perform it live. I like it a great deal.
Is that 7-inch still sealed? Have you ever played it?
No, of course I've never played it. Coheed famously covers Iron Maiden's The Trooper, and Jimmy Eat World famously covers Lamb's Last Christmas.
Oh, excellent. So you can lose the Last Christmas Challenge, Whamageddon Last Christmas Challenge, because of Jimmy Eat World.
No, because the rules of Whamageddon are it has to be Wham's Last Christmas. You can listen to variants and not be gotten out.
Disqualified.
Yeah. Question number four. In this episode, Piggy shouts, "Eat your heart out, Kiki," while performing Don't Go Breaking My Heart. Mm. To whom is she referring? A. Kiki Byrne, a London-based fashion designer who designed Elton's elaborate costumes. B. Kiki D, an English pop singer who Elton signed to his record label. Or C. Kiki McDonough, a British jeweler who provided Elton's signature earring and rings.
Now, I asked you whether or not I could research who Kiki was when I saw that piece of dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and you said, please don't. However, in just looking up the dates and release of Don't Go Breaking My Heart on Wikipedia, it did say what the name of the co-star was. So I'm gonna say...
I will stop you before you answer.
Yeah?
That doesn't necessarily mean that's who she was referring to.
Okay.
You can still stick with that answer, though.
I'm gonna say Keith D.
Yeah, it's still obviously that. I was just trying to throw you off at the last second.
But yeah, I'd say that I don't get a point for that because...
No, I've had previous knowledge on things before, so it's totally fine. But as you said, Kiki D is the original female singer on Don't Go Breaking My Heart. She was signed to his record label. The other two Kikis are as their professions described, but they had no professional relationship with Elton John.
Okay.
I just looked up famous Kikis. For the fifth and final question, Elton John has obviously been nominated and won numerous awards, but he is not one of our EGOT guests, as he has never been nominated for an Emmy. He was nominated 3 out of the 5 songs in the 1994 Oscars, where he did win for Can You Feel the Love Tonight. Circle of Life and Hakuna Matata were both nominated as well.
Hmm.
So he had 3 of the 5 in 1 year for the same movie.
That's amazing that he still won one of them, that he didn't split his own vote that much.
Yep. The other songs nominated were a song called Look What Love Has Done from the movie Junior, which we've now mentioned 2 episodes in a row, by Carol Bayer Sager, James Newton Howard, James Ingram, and Patti Smith, and Make Up Your Mind from The Paper by perennial Oscar nominee and winner Randy Newman. He has won Tonys for Billy Elliot and The Lion King, but which of the following stage adaptations has Elton John not worked on? A. Lestat the Musical, based off The Vampire Chronicles by Anne Rice. B. The Devil Wears Prada, based off the Meryl Streep movie, based off the book, by Laura Weisberger. Or C. Magic Mike, based off of the Steven Soderbergh movie.
Magic Mike.
That is correct. Is coming this year. Elton John did not work on it. Lestat the Musical ran for 39 performances before closing. And The Devil Wears Prada is coming soon. So since Kiki Byrne didn't design his costumes, I wanted to shout out all of his various costume designers throughout the years, because there are many, and they obviously deserve shouting out. His first costumes were designed by the wife of one of his bass players, Annette Murray. His first official costumer was Annie Reavy. His most famous and iconic, take a shot, costumes were designed by Bob Mackie, later by Bill Whitton, Tommy Nutter. In the 90s, Gianni Versace designed costumes for him. And in the more recent years, Yoji Yamamoto has worked with Elton.
I will say that there is a fashion studio in Nashville, Tennessee, that is called Any Old Iron. They do metallic and glam fashion stuff. And on their webpage, they claim to have costumed Elton previously. So there is a Elton connection to another song that happens in this episode. They have a webpage that has photo shoots of various people. Elton is not in it, but Aubrey Plaza, Lauren Mabry, and Busy Phillips, amongst others, are prominently displayed there.
I don't have any more questions, but I have one last weird Elton John fact.
Yeah, please.
Which is that he has also collaborated with other non-expected projects, such as Tupac Shakur's posthumous single, Ghetto Gospel. Elton John has proclaimed that he loves hip-hop and would love to someday release a hip-hop record himself.
Yeah, I have a weird Elton John fact, which is that buried in the Wikipedia entry about Benny and the Jets is that part of the success of that single was attributed to the fact that it was first got its most amount of radio play in Detroit, and that in addition to making it high up on the overall charts, it really sprung up on specifically the soul music charts, which got Elton an appearance on Soul Train.
Well, I also learned this from Rocket Man, that after he left the band Bluesology, his first band, or maybe it was as part of that band, don't really know. It's not the most accurate of biopics. Yeah, I'm gonna...
You're really gonna drive this into the ground.
Yeah, no.
They were supporting... I think that's pretty short-sighted of you, Pete. It's myopic.
Right, myopic.
Yeah, it's definitely Europic, because I'm not going anywhere near it.
I've never been to Europe, so I don't know.
I'm sorry, you were saying...
that in one of his very early gigs before he was Elton John, he supported a touring American soul act. So they were the openers. His band was the backing band for this group. So he has connections to that and very well may have been because of that. I can't say who that was because I don't remember.
But Blues Traveler.
Definitely not. This act did not give Elton John the runaround. So that may have been one of the reasons why he was so popular in Detroit, because he had these connections to that type of music. The last interesting, unexpected collaboration is he did a grunge song with the band Alice in Chains called Black Gives Way to Blue, which was a tribute to the original lead singer Layne Staley of Alice in Chains, who passed away because of a drug overdose in 2002. Guitarist Jerry Cantrell reached out to Elton John for this collaboration because Cantrell and Staley's very first concert together was an Elton John concert. So he was an important connection to the two of them.
Being forbidden from reading the main Elton John entry, but skimming some of the song pages on the individual singles that he performed in this episode, definitely one of them, I'm going to say probably the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road entry, talks about how there's an enormous amount of John's canon that is connected to accidental death. That is one of the runners in his opus is mourning songs and elegies. And obviously, Candle in the Wind after 1997 was very much attached to him, but that's not who he wrote it for initially.
But it is the highest selling single of all time. And also, I learned in Rocket Man that at his height, the height of his run, he was responsible for, I think, 8% of all record sales.
Wow.
And in 2017, he was still responsible for 2% of all record sales. So one in every 50 albums is an Elton John album that someone is buying digitally.
Wow, I feel terrible because I've bought none, which means somebody out there has bought 2 out of 50.
He has a lot of records. He released 7 number one albums in a row. Just very, very impressive.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the very few brushes of trivia that I encountered in his Wikipedia entries. However, it wasn't until maybe the last 5 years that I was able to start appreciating some of his music. I think Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, I now think of as a really good, well-written song, but there was so many of his songs that were played on pop radio when I was a young person that I really disliked specifically the lyrics.
Before digging into that more, I'm going to dig into it a little bit.
Yeah.
What did you think of him musically in those songs that you didn't like? Was it just lyrically that you didn't like? Or were you also like, this is pop and I don't like it?
No, I liked pop. I grew up in an era of pop. I listened to Cyndi Lauper. I listened to Hall & Oates. I was a pop kid.
But for example, the songs that you bounced off of.
Yep.
Lyrically, but what about musically?
That was it was definitely those combinations okay. of the things. There's a terrible stand-up act from the late 80s, early 90s that I've
only
carried
one?
That I've carried around rent-free in my head for a really long time, which is some guy talking about that's why they call it the blues, mm-hmm. and going through his lyrics and saying, none of these is actually things that would make you say, my life is depressing and things are bad. Any blues singer worth his salt would spit on Elton John's list and say, you don't have any idea what the blues are. And then comes up with a parody verse in the same meter. I didn't think his verse was particularly funny, but I did at least enjoy for a little bit the idea that somebody else was like, these lyrics don't work for me.
So the reason I asked about musically
yeah.
is because at least in the Bernie collaborations, I can't speak about otherwise.
Yeah.
Any Bernie song, Elton John has written zero lyrics.
Yep.
They've never actually written a song together.
Hmm.
Bernie hands John lyrics. John then goes away and writes music to them and then plays Bernie the song. That's how every single one of their collaborations has worked. They met because they both replied to an ad. And the guy to get Elton out of his office, according to the movie, just handed him lyrics and said, write something to this. And then they started collaborating together after that.
Well, let's talk about Elton in something real, which is to say, interacting on an elevated soundstage with a bunch of people's arms
mm-hmm.
and in this episode, and talk about his performance, his contributions, and how excited the Muppets were to have him on the show.
Yeah.
So much so that in the very beginning...
Well, not the very beginning, Ben. Slightly after the very beginning.
The very beginning is... Scooter coming into the dressing room to say 15 seconds to curtain.
Again?
Yes, we've had a slew of 15 seconds, which I think lends credence to your theory that they're trying to time it with that's how long the entry should, the joke should take mm-hmm. before the curtain.
They were 1 second off. It was 16 seconds.
Elton says that he's glad to be there and he's happy that even his lunch likes him. The camera then zooms back in order to show him in front of a panoply of food-based Muppets. We have a cantaloupe, grapes, a burger, pasta, fries, and a brown furry thing that does not look like food and frankly scared me.
Yeah, and he salts it all enthusiastically as it cuts to Kermit.
But then we have to what I was alluding, which is Kermit when he says Mr. Elton John in the O of the Muppet Show. They have, in addition to the normal fake applause, mixed in Beatles-esque female shrieking.
It's the Muppet Show with our special guest star, Mr. Elton John!
Yeah. Which then comes back recurrently over the course of the episode. They are juicing the fangirls of Elton John in the audience mix.
They're definitely capitalizing on that Beatles-esque Elvis-type
mm-hmm.
reactions. I imagine some of the Muppets in the audience fainted shortly after that.
But only the tweens and under. So Robin was definitely yes. affected.
Absolutely. Janice is too cool for it.
And it gives some indication as to why Scooter would be acting the way he does.
True. True. He's a teen, as we've established.
Right.
We then see two gags we've already seen.
Yes, the Sattler and Waldorf running in silently is in the Don Knotts episode, and Gonzo spritzing water out of the end of the trumpet is from the Milton Berle episode.
Kermit then intros Elton John, and there's nothing special about the intro. There's no jokes. It's just, welcome to the show. Here's Elton John, pretty much. And then we see Crocodile Rock, the outfit that I talked about in our
And trip. Peacock is pretty much the perfect description of it. Mm-hmm. The set is designed to be a jungle landscape, which allows there to be some rivers running through with crocodiles in it, We have the crocodile puppet that we've had from the Ugly Song, where there was a crocodile that I was convinced was an alligator, and now I'm definitely proven wrong. And two additional crocodile puppets, which have not been as fully rendered. They're basically sock arm puppets with no body. There's just a long sleeve ending in a crocodile head. So there's one fully swimming bodied crocodile and two cheat crocodiles, still with the big long noses and mouths and faces, but given as little extra as that as possible. And they tend to try and keep their heads as close to the boundary line as they can in order to hide the fact that there's really nothing there.
Nope.
And the Electric Mayhem are in outfits that are also sort of jungle-esque. No one's wearing a pith helmet, but Animal is wearing a Tarzan leopard print sash.
And then they basically just play the song.
You have in the past said that you were bored by things that were just playing the song. I was a little distracted by paying attention to how certain members of the band weren't in shot, depending on the camera angle, and trying to figure out if that was a coverage thing, if that was a thing because the puppeteers were needing to play the crocodiles, or what was going on. But in general, depending on where the camera's placed, we don't actually have all four members of the Mayhem consistently on stage, which is a strange technical thing that they're trying to hide, but I still was distracted by. So I was at least entertained by that.
And unlike other Electric Mayhem segments that I criticize, there's very dynamic camera movements. Mm-hmm. There's
big sweeping pans going on.
You also get images of his hands playing the keys. Mm-hmm. You get an image where you can't see his hands, and it's the master shot, primary shot. And the crocodile, I honestly didn't really pay attention to the Electric Mayhem at all, because there's the crocodiles in the foreground. Yeah. During every chorus of the Laws, Elton conducts the crocodiles.
And in the second time that they do this, he stands up from the piano to conduct them, and then loses his balance and falls into the water below.
Yeah, they're also getting aggressive with him, so he actually hits one of them at one point for the first hit of the episode.
And then, after the end of that musical number, is when we've had the previously established backstage, where the crocodiles come on before the Swedish Chef leaves from backstage, and Kermit admonishes them with what I thought for 20 years is a really great punchline: how many times do I have to tell you never eat the guest star at the beginning of the show?
Yeah. Although before that, we do have a Statler and Waldorf bit.
That's right.
They say, at the same time, see you later, alligator. They made the same mistake that you have previously. It's fine. It's still
a
good joke.
Would you have preferred it if one of them said, after see you later, alligator, and then the second one said, after a while, crocodile?
No, because I'm fine with this. I think it's fun that they did it at the same time.
Yeah. After the Swedish Chef segment and the second Statler and Waldorf interstitial, we have Elton in the dressing room wearing his second major outfit change. The first one, as we said, was very peacock plumage. This one is a purple jacket with green trim in sequins that are shaped like lizards. He's then wearing a variation on kind of a Greek fisherman's cap and a t-shirt underneath that, and with lenses that match the hat, I believe, not the jacket.
Mm-hmm. Oh, here's another fact that I didn't write a trivia question about.
Yeah.
Elton John's glasses, he did not need them initially.
Hmm.
They were purely cosmetic, but he wore them so long, he wore out his eyes, and now he requires heavy, heavy big glasses. So only wear your glasses when you're supposed to, kids. Otherwise, your eyes will get lazy and you'll require them all the time. Take it from me.
This is the continuation of the earlier setup of Kermit and Scooter pushing the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And Kermit is apologizing for the fact that there is a piano in the dressing room and wants to explain what's going on. He starts by talking about Scooter and explaining what a gopher is, and then basically throws him under the bus by saying, his uncle owns the theater, I really need you to at least listen to this, because it's not that I'm being unprofessional, it's that I'm being desperate.
After getting the permission or the consent from Elton to allow Scooter to do it, Kermit calls them in. Scooter and a whole bunch of other characters come in, and they play what sounds like nonsense to me.
La 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 la
Yeah, it's very dissonant, it's clashy, it's high-pitched, and I did not recognize it at all. Elton's making a huge face, and Kermit then leaps in to say, I told you, Scooter, that's awful, it has no melody.
The song lyrics is tasteless.
And then looks to Elton for confirmation, who then says, well, I certainly didn't think that when I wrote it.
Kermit gives the shocked, surprised shake face, and then immediately backpedals, saying the opposites of the things he just said about it.
But loses steam, and when pressed by Elton, he says, you really hated it? And Kermit says, yeah, I really did. And Elton says, well, maybe you'd like it more if it sounded like this. And then reveals what maybe certain people would have been able to figure out was the opening bars too, but I would have been totally hornswoggled if that was in a quiz. Like, here are the first 8 bars of a song. Tell me what the rest of it is.
On the rewatch,
yeah,
the very end of the Scooter version has those...
Dun, yeah. Da-da-dun, da-dun.
So that is the only recognizable piece to me that I was like, oh yeah, it is. It was a redo, not the right word,
interpretation?
Yeah, sure. That's easy. of Benny and the Jets. But otherwise, I could not tell.
Previously, with Crocodile Rock, that was his 13th single. It was the first number one single in the U.S., only got to number 5 in the U.K., and was released in the fall of 72 prior to the U.S. release of his 6th studio album, Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player. Benny and the Jets is his 18th single release, having come out in February of 74 as part of his 7th studio album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which was released in 73. There were 3 other singles from that album. This was the 4th. The first single was a song I don't really know. No, that's not true. The first single from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. Mm-hmm. And then Goodbye Yellow Brick Road followed. So he did good business with singles on the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road full album. This also made it to number 1 in the U.S., but weirdly enough, only made it to 37 in the U.K. in 1976, 2 years later.
Interesting.
So it was not formally released as a single at the same time in the U.K. And this is what he performed on Soul Train. Benny and the Jets was his soul release that was supported first by Detroit and got so much radio play there, according to Wikipedia, that other radio stations were like, I think we need to play this as well, even though they didn't think that it was going to have legs.
Mm. Well, sharks don't have legs. So if they're fighting the Jets,
then it makes a certain amount of sense.
Mm-hmm.
On land, it's just not a good idea. They do a very abbreviated version of this. They do the first verse and then the chorus and then a quick second chorus. So it's really more of a teaser than anything else.
Yeah, it's only 1 minute and 5 seconds of Benny and the Jets.
Very short.
Scooter's version was 14 seconds.
Too long. After Benny and the Jets, we go to Vet's Hospital.
Piggy's got some business. She's blowing into a tube, inflating a bladder.
And then when she sees that she's being observed, she sucks the air back in and gets the hiccups.
And then joins the rest of the crew, at which point we're revealed, Animal Watch, it's a dog.
Which is pretty much exactly what Dr. Bob says. He says, it's a dog. Not recognizing that this is Baskerville, with whom he's been in sketches. 2 that I can think of.
Rolf has been in sketches. Dr. Bob has not been in sketches.
Well said, sir. He's not breaking character.
No.
Okay. I give him a pass.
Yeah, and then they just do dog jokes.
Any ones you actually liked?
The note that I made of what I liked on this segment is the dog's face when it laughs at the jokes. But otherwise, I did not note any of the jokes.
I'll say that after establishing the first very obvious watchdog joke, they then move to guard dog, which they don't have a good joke for, but it's a good transition into what I think is the one good joke of the episode, which is that Dr. Bob states that he once knew a watchdog that attacked his owner. And when Piggy guesses at the breed by saying Doberman Pinscher, Dr. Bob says, no, Doberman Bitter.
Oh, yes. I did, at the very, very end, there's sort of like the screaming for Elton. They pipe in howling.
See, that's not what I got. I thought they were booing. The last two jokes, I think the audience booed.
Oh, see, it sounded like dog howls to me.
Huh.
Oh, I wish he was a dachshund.
Why?
I'd like to get a long little doggy.
No!
And I would have liked
that's
it
funnier
to have been throughout it instead of just at those two jokes. Mm-hmm. If, like, with every one, it got a little bit louder as they got to the end, and then eventually it's just dogs howling the entire time.
At the first time that it happens, they all look sideways as if mm-hmm. confused, and immediately after that, the voice comes in and they look up. So even that sort of undercuts whatever's going on.
Right, which is why I wanted it more throughout the segment.
I agree. I think that whatever it should have been clearer mm-hmm. and given more time to breathe. Much like Piggy at the very beginning of the episode.
Oh, also another note. Vets Hospital was cut on Nickelodeon.
Interesting.
Don't know why. Had no speculation.
Had a theory that some of the Swedish Chef stuff would have been cut on Nickelodeon. And since we talked about all the Swedish Chef runners and you didn't mention that, I assumed I had to be wrong. But I didn't have, while I have memories of the backstage segments of this episode, I had almost no memory of the Swedish Chef Beck. And I sort of assumed, well, maybe threatening somebody with a meat cleaver wasn't appropriate for the tiny tots on Nick Jr.
I wonder if it's because it's reversed on him that it's like, oh, it's don't okay. do it. It's a, yeah, because if you do it, it might go badly for you.
But you didn't see any indications on the Wikia that any of that stuff had been cut?
Nope. The only notes are that Vets Hospital was cut.
Huh. Okay. Then my memories are just inaccurate. The next sketch is...
Oh, see, I was hoping you were going to take the lead on this, because I was going to play dumb. Because the next sketch is not on Disney Plus, it's DVD only.
So, I was confused here, because there is a quick fade to black, and then a fade up on a sketch which I assumed was the UK spot.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I didn't know you could play the piano.
I didn't know it either.
I'll join in.
And then, after that, there's another fade to black, which then comes back with a music hall sketch. And mm-hmm. I was like, wait, are there two UK spots? So in researching the songs, as I always do, I was then told by the fandom page...
This is a future UK spot.
That this is on the DVD for reasons that nobody knows, but that this sketch will show up in 4 production episodes' time. And why... the DVDs decided to stick it in the middle of this one is a mystery. So, if we're going to talk about this in a future episode, and you didn't watch it...
I did watch it.
Okay.
But I agree with your premise of, let's talk about it in the episode that it appears on where most of our listeners
will be able to see it.
Yeah. Or, you could skip ahead to 218, watch just this one, and then come back. Don't do that.
Well, it's a really good sketch. Mm-hmm. I understand why people would want to put it in many episodes. I think it should be slotted in 2 more Muppet Show episodes. So I think you guys should find this on YouTube and then just periodically, while you're watching The Muppet Show, play this. If you're watching a sketch that you don't enjoy, play English Country Garden instead. I guarantee you it's more fun. But since we're going to talk about this sketch when we do production episode 218... let us skip merrily past that, as if we are traipsing through an English country garden, and instead talk about the episode's actual UK spot, which is Any Old Iron. This is, as I mentioned, a true blue traditional season 2 English music hall bit.
Yep.
And boy is it.
Yep. The pendulum swings so hard, because I don't know what that future episode is going to look like, moment-wise. But this was going to be some of my moments. English Country Garden, I have bolded all over the place.
It's a wonderful sketch, everybody. You're going to really like it when we get to the J.P. Morgan episode.
Yeah. Whereas UK spot, boring. It's just a music hall episode. I now have learned enough music hall to know that this is a music hall song. However...
yeah.
Never mind, I take all of that back.
Because?
There is an audience shot, and the guru's eyes are not scary.
You know whose eyes are scary in this sketch?
No.
There are two Whatnot Muppets who appear in this, and according to the footnotes of this on the fandom page, one of the two of them is puppeteered by Louise Gold. And in the sketch, that puppet is missing the dot in its flat plastic eye. And they discovered that it was missing afterwards, but they were filming it as the very last sketch of the day. They didn't have time to film it twice, so that is a one-and-done sketch, according to an interview that Louise Gold did in 1999. And she said, we didn't have the ability to fix any of it, so we did one take of it, and that was it, and that's why the eyeball is missing on that puppet.
Huh. Also, speaking of Louise Gold, since you brought her up, even though we said she doesn't get credited until season 3, she's in the credits of this episode.
Oh! But that's because, if I'm not mistaken, these are the UK credits, because they're pushed over left Justified on the screen as opposed to the center Justified US credits.
Also, the director was listed last instead of very first, because I had to watch them twice and be like, wait, did I miss who directed it? Because this is a Peter Harris episode.
Yeah, and so every so often you get, for some reason of the editing, you get the UK credits on an episode, and this is one of those. Any Old Iron dates back to the music hall traditions of, and was originally apparently performed in 1911. And weirdly enough, it had a bit of a resurgence in 1954, where it was performed on The Goon Show by Peter Sellers and by Spike Milligan, two future Muppet Show guests. And it appeared in The Boyfriend with Julie Andrews, a future Muppet Show guest. And I don't know if it is or is not in the film version of The Boyfriend, which starred Twiggy when it was made in the early 70s. So, weirdly enough, it's got huge Muppet Show crossover prior to actually appearing in The Muppet Show. There was also a 1965 cover in the self-titled album by David Jones, who went on to be Davy Jones of the Muppets. And did you understand these breakneck lyrics that were spat out by Kermit and Fozzie? Do you care what the story of this song is?
Well, that's two different answers.
True.
Because, yes, I did understand them. No, I hated it.
The basic, quote, humorous, unquote, premise of this song is that people are wearing watch chains, and they're very proud of their elegant watch chains, and they get called out by both children on the street and choristers in a church, saying, your watch chain is so garish, it doesn't look like it's gold or precious metal. It might as well be scrap metal to be picked up by a tinsmith in the street on his horse cart.
Okay, correction and amendment to what I previously said. Yes, I did understand the lyrics. No, I did not comprehend the lyrics. Or vice versa, whichever one is correct. But option 2 still stands, still didn't like it.
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly funny. It's also not that dissimilar to Burlington Birdie, which I think is interesting, that maybe this is a ongoing theme to music hall performances of stuffed shirts who are being brought down for pretending to be posh, and then the whole chorus, the whole audience participation aspect is being able to go, you toff, you jerk, get down where you belong. That to me feels very British.
Yeah. But I think the reason why they did this is not because of that thematic. It's just fun that they speed it up until they can't go any faster, which is fun and is the only part of the song that I enjoyed, but I still didn't like it.
Yeah, I do not connect emotionally to this sketch or this song.
I did like, though, to say something positive, Fozzie bopping around in the background.
Do you remember Fozzie's outfit?
No, of course not.
In the very first episode we covered this season, production episode 210 with George Burns, but the very first broadcast episode, Fozzie does a performance of Watcher Catch 'Em in the Old Something Road. I couldn't remember last time either. It's not Old Silk Road, and that's what my brain keeps on producing. And he was wearing this same weird outfit of a black hat and a vest with bright white shiny buttons all over it. And I said, I knew I've seen that someplace before, but I don't know what it is. And no amount of Googling could have brought it up. Well, the Muppet fandom page finally had an entry about it that was able to point me in the right direction. which is that he is representing what was called a pearly king or pearly queen, which is when people were trying to raise money through donations, one of the things they would do is take their outfits and using mother of pearl buttons all over the seams to make themselves bright and shiny, and then this would attract people down. But it was the help of famed internet presence Nick Locking that finally got me to understand where I'd seen it before, which was in the Grant Morrison issues of Batman and Robin, where there is a character when Batman is in the UK who is dressed like a pearly king as a strange UK representative crime lord that Grant Morrison made up for 5 or 6 pages. And I'd seen it in that comic, but I couldn't have possibly remembered that without the help of a smarter nerd than I.
He looks like a monochrome Elton John.
That is a great description. I'd, at the time, in the George Burns episode, I thought that they might have had something to do with the Queen's Centennial. And nope.
Then we have Scooter introducing Elton John very understatedly, as I talked about earlier, because the Swedish Chef and Chicken run through. So then we get to Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Funny, I didn't remember seeing Mel Gibson in this episode. There was a chicken run through. And then we have Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Once again, accompanied by the Electric Mayhem.
Mm-hmm. But not in any way that really highlights them. This is where we start to recognize that there aren't really sketches here in the Elton John performances. He's basically, the previous Benny and the Jets bit at least has the lead-in of the comic premise of they're doing his song, and it's short enough that probably the intro to that is about the length of the performance.
Yeah.
And Crocodile Rock had the comic element of the crocodile singing the song and a little bit of peril. This has nothing except straight performance. The Mayhem are doing nothing.
It is not nearly as visually interesting as Crocodile Rock.
What I did spend the entire time watching this is trying to figure out if this is lip-synced or not. If it is lip-synced, it is perhaps the best lip-syncing I've ever seen in my life. Until the final bit of vocalization, the lost ooh that is done at the end of the song. But there are some things that lead me to believe that that ooh was dubbed in as a closer to the song and that everything else is live. And my theory is as follows. First of all, he seems to be hand perfect and teeth perfect in his performance of this. But secondly, there are 2 microphones on the open piano, and they are corded. And one is going to the microphone in front of Elton, and the other is going into the piano itself. And so I don't think they would have those mic cords there for decoration if they weren't actually needing to use the audio. I think they would just had a microphone for him to sing into, or no microphone at all, and he would have been singing to the camera.
Yeah.
So the fact that they mic'd him and mic'd the piano leads me to think that at least Elton's part of this is performed live. And once you look at that, and you look at the camera work, it seems very clear to me that the way in which they use dissolves and the way in which they use zooms is because it was performed live and they couldn't really do the same kind of cuts that you would do if you were working from a recorded track.
Right. I was just going to say it's a ballad, so you can't really do a comedic game.
Mm.
And it was introduced, so there's no sketch premise to it because he was introduced as
the greatest talent in the history of the universe, Elton John!
Typically when an act is introduced that way, it's just an act.
Yeah. But first of all, this is his third performance, because the second performance, which happened in the place of a talk spot or a backstage sketch,
the audience may or may not have seen it.
But in terms of number of musical performances we tend to get from a guest sketch,
we usually get 3.
Yes. And so this could have been, and I was wondering if it was going to be, his final performance of the episode. At which point, yes, then playing it straight is what you want to do. You don't necessarily want to do comic undercuts of the big finale. But if it's the second one, that's actually the one you do want to play games with.
Yeah, they should have switched this in the next one.
Well,
For that reason. I don't think they
or
actually
they could
have
come up with something to do with this. It's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. You could do something with the Wizard of Oz premise. You could have Fozzie as the Scarecrow coming in and interrupting, like each verse with a different character, have him singing it without the piano accompaniment, and they're walking through scenes from Wizard of Oz. That was just a dumb thing off the top of my head, but I think when they met with Elton John, they decided what they wanted to do was not undercut his music. They wanted this to be a showcase and not of him playing with his reputation. They wanted him to do his songs as best as possible.
Yeah, this is obviously not the full song either, but it's nearly 3 minutes.
This was his 16th single, so this came out two releases prior to Benny and the Jets. And my fun piece of Elton John trivia that came from Wikipedia with regard to this song is that the B-side on the single of this was originally called in the UK Screw You.
Oh, it wasn't Sucker Punch Training?
It wasn't, but it might as well have been. And when they decided to release the single in the US, they were like, I don't think we can call it that for a sensitive US market. And so instead it was retitled Young Men's Blues. But also, that I think plays into this conversation of they didn't want to mess with the vibe of this.
Yeah. I really like the way he sings Toad. The emphasis on the O in Toad is very odd, and I really enjoy it.
Back to the howling hole out in the woods, I'm hunting a hornet-back toad.
After Goodbye Yellow Brick Road is Pigs in Space, and at the conclusion of Pigs in Space, we then have the backstage segment that opens with the chicken chasing the chef with a cleaver.
But after that, which we skipped over beforehand, after the Swedish chef and the chicken leave, Sam enters, and he confronts Kermit, saying he has some concerns about the guest star Elton John.
I love the writing of this sketch. Sam is often colorfully verbose, and there's so many great instances in this of little turns of phrase that Sam and Oz really do a great job selling. But the premise here is that he thinks Elton John's wild dress sense is so over the top, he's concerned that this might be the weirdest guest they've ever had.
Yeah.
Kermit says, musicians have always been fancy dressers, Sam. And Sam claims, Mozart wasn't.
Which Kermit then says, Mozart wore high heels, wigs, and silk stockings. Which Sam is very offended by.
And he says that if Mozart did any of those things, he'll eat his hat.
Kermit then asks if he'll also give the guest star a big introduction if it ends up being true.
Sam is so in on this, he doubles down and says yes, that too. And Scooter comes out with a portrait of Mozart that he claims Elton John just gave him. And Sam very quickly realizes that this has all been a sting operation. And he has been, as he puts it, hornswoggled.
But Sam's the one who brought up Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
So how could it have been a sting operation? If he said Beethoven, if he said anyone else, then this wouldn't have worked.
Do you don't think that somebody as well-trained in improv as Kermit, if Kermit had said, to bring up a composer that we definitely haven't talked about this episode, if he had said Boccherini instead of Mozart, if he had said Beethoven, that Kermit wouldn't have said, yes, but anybody like that. Boccherini, Beethoven, Mozart, they all wore. And then he could have backed Sam into a corner.
Yeah, but then he would have been right in being hornswoggled.
Mm.
But there was none of that.
They just knew Sam that well.
Yeah,
that Mozart was his go-to guy.
Yeah.
Oh, it doesn't make sense.
No, but it's great.
He gets stung. He gets well and truly set up. And then the two whatnots from the UK spot hustle him behind a pink screen. And we cut to being in front of the curtain where Sam is led on in a glittery Uncle Sam outfit. Looks like something Evel Knievel would have ridden over a canyon in.
Yeah, a rhinestoned out American Eagle costume that the guest star would be thrilled to wear. And so Sam blandly reads the intro. And then as he's about to leave, Kermit goes,
and
Sam takes a bite out of his hat, except he doesn't at all.
Well, yeah, because much like when Gonzo was eating a rubber tire to the music of the Flight of the Bumblebee.
No, but he barely even puts it in his mouth. That's my main issue. It's like, I understand he can't actually take a bite out of that hat, but he could have at least put the hat in his mouth.
He still makes nomming noises.
Yeah, but he nibbles at the brim and doesn't take a bite out of it. He takes a nibble out of it. I hate it.
So we have the final Elton John performance, which is what you are saying is the more comedic of the four that we have.
In the performance of, yes.
Yeah.
I think, as you were saying with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, that if you want to end with the dramatic point, then yeah, that's why I was suggesting switch these two. But this is a bigger show-ending piece, I guess.
I think only because it has Human Muppet interaction.
Yeah.
And so it feels like the culmination of the show in that it's humans and Muppets performing together, which is what we've come to want out of the Muppet Show. Is if they just had Elton John doing Yellow Brick Road, yes, it would have been emotional, but we also would have criticized it for being isolated from the Muppets. And
sure.
So we really do need what it ends up being, which is a duet between Elton and Miss Piggy.
Yeah, because he introduces her. So after being introduced by Sam, he then goes, well, I've got to bring out my guest for this. And then she enters saying kissy kissy twice.
Upon the release of The Muppet Show on Disney+, pretty much every news agency in the country did various articles on what is good and what is bad about The Muppet Show. And in Entertainment Weekly in 2021, when that happened, they ran an article about what they considered to be the essential elements of a Muppet Show episode. You need to have a guest star that you have backstage segments with, that they have a guest musical number and a regular musical number, that you need to have segments, according to them, that focus on Piggy, Animal, and Statler and Waldorf, that you need to have a Pigs in Space, and you need to have a heartfelt moment somewhere in the course of the episode. And they introduced their segment about how you have to have a Piggy bit by saying that most guests, according to them, when asked to be on the show and said, well, what do you want to do when you're on the show? Their first request is, I want to do something with Miss Piggy.
As I mentioned with Rudolph Nureyev.
Yes. And they listed this segment here of Elton and Piggy performing Don't Go Breaking My Heart as what they consider to be one of the best Piggy segments in the entire show.
Hmm. I don't know that I would go that far. It's very enjoyable. I don't dislike it at all. But I don't...
I would have even done the Kate Ballard segment is better than this.
I would maybe even say the Rudolph Nureyev segment. Because it's sort of like what we were saying with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. This is fairly straightforward, and that was very creative. Besides the interactions at the beginning with them, it's just them performing the song.
In fact, there are very few camera setups that do anything interesting with it. It's basically a locked shot on the two of them, sometimes for tens of seconds at a time without any cutaway. The Mayhem, it's the exact same set that they used for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, but it's lit differently, with the Mayhem basically in silhouette against a bright blue backdrop behind
them. Yeah, the only thing that kind of is special about this is Piggy improvises lots of whoos and woos and things like that, and then towards the end, lots and lots of kisses.
Right from the start, I gave you my heart. Oh, I gave you my heart.
Yeah, so by the end of the second verse or the second chorus is when Piggy buries her snout in the open V of the jumpsuit and basically starts kissing Elton in his chest hair. And then as we come round to the end of the third verse and the repetition of the chorus and into the applause, it becomes a massive smooch fest in terms of her just puckering up and kissing him in the face, the chest, the neck, and every place she can get her snout into.
He reciprocates two kisses.
Yep.
But yeah, I counted 19 or 20 because there are a lot.
It's almost like she's digging for truffles in there.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of actual humorous tension in this. She's not overplaying it.
She's doing a little bit of a voice, but mostly she's just gazing up at him and he's looking down at her, and they're doing the equivalent of a straight romantic duet without any real action.
Yep.
The one takeaway is that, as you mentioned earlier, about halfway through the song, she turns to camera and says, "Eat your heart out, Kiki."
Because she was the, as I said, original person to record this with him.
She was the opposite end of the duet, and now Piggy is being like, "Ha ha, I've got him now.
He's mine." And by the end of it, maybe he is. At this point, he was still closeted.
Hmm.
I think it's around this time he may have come out as bisexual. And in 1984, he does marry a woman, which lasted for 4 years. And then it was after that that he corrected and said, no, I'm gay. So, yeah, I just don't know if he's still completely closeted at this point.
But I think first of all, for family entertainment on 7:30 at night on a Monday in the U.S., and with the amount of work that they've done, as I previously mentioned, in terms of sweetening the laugh track,
mm-hmm.
of it being a female-centric kind of fandom, I think they're leaning into a perception of he's a heartthrob for girls in the editing of this episode.
Yeah.
So they don't seem to be doing any work to expand that.
No, certainly not. After this song ends, we cut to Statler and Waldorf in their box, and they're wearing their own bedazzled outfits, one of which looks like a dressing gown.
Waldorf is dressed pretty clearly to me like a sheik, except in pink.
Yes.
And Statler is wearing a robe with a giant sparkly collar behind his head.
Yeah, but the sheik outfit kind of looks like a bathrobe with a cap.
And I'm not saying that they didn't buy a child's bathrobe and dye it pink and then put it on Waldorf. I'm just saying it's very clearly supposed to be some kind of Rudy Valentino-esque callback.
And this is what we were alluding to earlier when we talked about the running bit of saying that they were in
interesting outfits.
Yes, because they're still wearing them when the Swedish Chef and Chicken run through.
Again, we're leaving him out of this.
Who?
Mel. Chicken Run through.
See, I think of that as a Zach Braff vehicle.
Zach Braff isn't in Chicken Run.
Isn't he?
No, it's the girl from Ab Fab, and it's Mel Gibson.
Zach Braff is in Chicken Little. Okay. I'm not completely wrong.
No, I get where you're doing now.
Yep. Okay.
So, yes, that's the outfits that they're wearing in the Chicken Little through. And then we have the curtain call.
Yep.
With Kermit and Scooter first, and Fozzie first showing up in crazy get-ups as well, with the rest of the cast, mostly the puppets that we've previously outfitted from the Benny and the Jets segment.
Yeah, Piggy's wearing a pink wig.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not Piggy in the pink wig. That's the pig from Benny and the Jets. Piggy is wearing the same outfit she was wearing just now in Don't Go Breaking My Heart, with the addition of a pair of sunglasses.
Oh, okay. See, I just saw
a pig in a wig.
Yeah, and figured it was Piggy in the wiggy.
Well, when we go shopping at a Piggly Wiggly, we can definitely look for that outfit. So, we haven't seen Fozzie's outfit, Scooter's outfit, or I think Scooter is wearing a different outfit than the ice cream t-shirt and jean jacket that he's been wearing previously in the episode.
No, he's still wearing the...
Okay. Does he have an addition of sunglasses and a hat?
He's still wearing his glasses, but he's got feathers.
Okay.
So he's slightly more decked out.
So Kermit and Fozzie are really the only two that have brand new outfits for this closer.
Yeah.
Okay. And the stage is populated with all the other glam outfits from Benny, at which point when they bring in Elton, he is wearing a gray wool suit and a gray flat cap and very ordinary glasses. This is where we have a callback to something we didn't mention earlier in the Sam backstage segment, where he describes Elton as having dressed like a stolen car.
Mm-hmm.
And Elton calls back to that now, saying, "You are all dressed like stolen cars."
But there's another callback, too, because Sam says that Elton might be the weirdest guest.
Mm.
And at this point, Scooter says, "Boy, Elton, you look weird." So there's double callbacks.
I've been using the phrase dressed like a stolen car for a really long time because of this episode. Very briefly, I did a Google Ngram search of that to see how often that phrase had come up in books that Google has nearly scanned into their database. And in 1931, there was a use of the phrase like a stolen car that had to do with speed. The very premise being that if you do something like a stolen car, it's because you're trying to get away with as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1974, in a civil service journal about discussing graduates from art college that were bringing their portfolios to various clients, they said that young people who were just starting out in the graphic design business had overly complicated visual designs to things, and the quote that they used when they were interviewing clients who were unhappy with these new graduates was that they designed as if they were dressed like a stolen car.
Hmm.
So I'd say right at this time in the 70s, it might have had a very brief surge of being used in that way.
Yeah, and I can definitely see that getting popular and then people using it to describe Elton John. Very clearly.
It's a fun phrase that I have used a number of times and no one has ever known what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because I think that practice of stealing a car and then spray painting the hell out of it and abandoning it isn't really a thing anymore.
That's the episode.
So Pete, you have given us not a tally of all the hits, but in a timey-wimey indirect list of all the hits. And we've talked about perhaps the greatest amount of kisses that has ever happened in a Muppet Show episode. What other statistics and what final numbers do you want to give us?
So in terms of statistics, we had 7 hits, no explosions, 19 kisses is what I finally settled on. How many there were.
I definitely watched that scene thinking you had your work cut out for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's 19 or 20. I'm confident in that. So I'm okay with taking the under slightly. In terms of music, Ben, do we have a new leader in the clubhouse?
I'm going to guess yes.
If we included the second UK spot, we would. But because we are not talking about it, it is number 2.
Mm.
Bernadette Peters still in the lead. This is now 52.53% music.
So Bernie's music outstripped Bernie's lyrics.
Yes. And despite Bernie's episode not having any songs about Benny, she's still in the lead.
Well, that is a Benny fit to us all.
Ooh, good one. Yes, there was 13.49 minutes of music out of 25.68 minutes of episode. Again, taking out the
future segment.
Now, we've alluded to it throughout the episode of how I'm going to rank this. And Ben, it's not fair. It's absolutely not fair. You have long claimed that I have no standards, and I still claim that I do. However, this is episode 13 for me.
Fascinating.
I love Elton John. Unlike you, I've always had a soft spot for him.
Huh.
And this just solidified it. And I was very, very conflicted the entire time watching
it. You should be. He has some of the worst Muppet-human interaction I've ever seen. His acting
is atrocious.
The thing that he does with Kermit, where he reacts to it, the song wasn't, I didn't think the song was terrible when I wrote it, is fine. And everything else he does is so disconnected. And he's just here.
It's inconsistent from line to line.
He's performing his hits. Mm-hmm. He's just doing what you criticize Steve for.
Absolutely. But you know what?
You have no standards.
You know what?
Pete?
I like his songs.
I'd
rather... See, here's the thing.
I know. This is what you do come in on when you're ranking stuff is, would I enjoy watching this again?
Yeah. And I would rather watch Steve Martin's bits in Steve Martin's special
than watch him do it with the Muppets.
Yeah. And
you would rather watch Elton do it with the Muppets than listen to his album.
Exactly.
I was convinced that because of the previous rules that you had established on this podcast, that you had been saving spot number 24 and that you were finally going to fill it And that we weren't even going to have to bump all those people that had been bumped and rebumped and rebumped the last few episodes. Because finally you had met somebody that was so bad at performing with the Muppets that you were going to regretfully fill that slot because you couldn't imagine a worse performance.
Nope.
I think that's still true, that you can't imagine a worse performance. You're just being biased for people whose songs you enjoy.
Yeah, maybe. But he's locked in at number 13. He's not going to move. That's probably a lie. But he's definitely going to be above Steve Martin. And I put him above other people, too, because, again, I couldn't justify putting him any higher than 13. Mm. Because, like,
he shouldn't be in the top half.
So, yeah, I guess he... Yeah. So, cool. Good. I'm glad you're happy with that part of it. But in thinking of everyone... in the bottom half, like, I'd rather watch Elton John again than the Edgar Bergen or the Teresa Brewer segments. So, simply,
even though it does all the things that normally bore the crap out of you in
but because
episode.
His songs are catchy and poppy and I grew up listening to them and they're not just standards or country music, yep, it biasedly gets put up to 13.
Okay.
I make things up as I go. I'm a true improviser.
I thought you were a sketch comedian. I thought you wrote things now.
I did. I wrote down Elton John 2x14-ep16 on line 13 of this spreadsheet.
Well, as it is the end of a series of four episodes, while we're doing stats, how did we do in terms of points for the trivia competition?
We were tied going into this episode. Mm. We each had 3 points. And so you only needed one correct answer to win a minifig. You got 4. You destroyed me 7-3.
Well, anybody with so few standards deserves so few minifigs. So I'm going to open up the box and take out one of the remaining 3. I'm going to choose from the middle.
Ben, what's in the box?
Let's find out what's in the bag, because that will tell us what's in the box. At least 1/3 of what's left in the box.
Please be a duplicate. Please be a duplicate.
I believe we have a balcony monster. We have Waldorf.
Ooh.
Wearing a brown suit with his preformed head. And in addition to his stand, he comes with 2 cups and saucers. So that you can sing along to the songs from the pogo of I may be your dish of tea, but baby, don't you sugar me. And he has a placard that says 3 Z's like he's sleeping. So he can share a cup of tea with somebody, but it's not enough to keep him awake.
Very good. All right, I'm mad about that one too.
In order to close out the episode, let us talk about our 5 favorite moments. In order to talk about something that we think is noteworthy, worthy of separating out from a full sketch, I'm going to begin by talking about a full sketch.
Oh, I'm the one with no standards.
The first backstage segment is the perfect encapsulation of what people want the Muppet Show to be. So I'm not actually talking about it as a sketch because it really isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
But what it is one of the best representations the show has done so far of getting that sense of controlled chaos that Kermit has to juggle.
Mm-hmm.
And to go from the crocodiles coming in, to the Swedish chef going out, to Piggy coming in, to him looking for Scooter and banging into the piano. That's very well choreographed. Everybody has a little bit of something in reaction to the show and creating that wonderful atmosphere of stuff going on. And mm-hmm. I think better than any other backstage segment I can think of, that is what I would want to show somebody in order to prove the premise of Kermit is the character on The Muppet Show who is trying and failing to keep everything in order because everything would fall apart without him. And it's sort of the quintessence of The Muppet Show. And so I wanted to give Peter Harris, who we've sort of been a little down on this particular season, very high props for managing, choreographing, and having all that action be clear. But also to reinforce what I said earlier about I thought this was a very well-written episode. Everything that happens in that backstage segment has a payoff later in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well done, everybody.
Plus, it has Jim Henson interacting with Jim Henson in a seamless manner.
Yep. To which we're still astounded by and have no idea.
I don't know.
For our second moment, my first moment, I'm going to talk about the chicken. Specifically, when, as you briefly talked about, and I was very happy that you just touched on it.
There was a chance I was also going to talk about it.
That's why I picked it as my first moment. And which is the chicken dancing to the intro music of The Swedish Chef and balking along to the borks.
So smart.
Yeah. It's so joyous. The chicken's not threatened yet, so it's still having a good time. It thinks it's about to just have some fun, maybe play a little prank on the Swedish Chef, doesn't realize that it's going to be chased to near death before then chasing the Swedish Chef. So yeah, the little dancing and the box. Priceless.
For our third moment, the second moment that I'm going to draw attention to, I'm going to bring up the end of the Pigs in Space sketch. We've talked a lot about how the engine for Pigs in Space this season seems to be about the gender dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely good stuff in there in terms of Piggy making fun of Link for crying and Link being afraid of snakes and hiding behind Piggy when the invaders come in. But weirdly enough, I think it's the satire of Star Trek that is the thing that I most enjoyed about this episode, which is the weird one-off line that Piggy says at the very end of the sketch was, once the Swedish Chef and the chicken have left, right before they go back to being bored, Piggy says,
"Somehow, I miss them."
Which feels like an echo of the kind of thing that Kirk or somebody would say in terms of, well, these strange extraterrestrials have come into our orbit and now they're gone, but we are forever changed by their... You know, it has that kind of dumb, lost in space melodrama in it. Again, writing for me. This is an episode about really good writing. And that line didn't need to be there. And yet they kept it in, I think, because it gets at the heart of the satire that is Pigs in Space, and mm-hmm. that they needed to leave it in for that. And Oz does a great job of delivering that strange non-joke moment that helps cap off the episode.
For our fourth moment, my second moment, I would also like to talk about Piggy.
Mm.
In Don't Go Breaking My Heart, when she enters, she says,
"Oh, Elton, have you been waiting long, Poopsie?"
Besides the who's that I mentioned earlier and her vocal improvisations, her calling Elton John Poopsie really tickled me. You may even go so far as to say, it tickled me pink. Pink like a pig.
It's good stuff. Well, to bring us all home, I'm going to bring us back to Sam being hornswoggled in the segment where he walks into the trap of being forced to make an ill-judged bet about whether or not Mozart wore high heels, wigs, and silk stockings. I've said hornswoggled three times in this episode so far, not counting that one I just did, because I accidentally said it as my own description earlier because it had been populated into my brain. I love this sketch. This is one of the sketches that I've had on tape and have replayed, and that would be the one you'd think I'd want to bring up because it's such a great, toothy, stupid word, but I'm going to go for
"Hold your little green tongue,"
which is what Sam says when Kermit asserts that Mozart wore this getup in the first place. First of all, Kermit does not have a green tongue. Anybody who's looked at Kermit's mouth knows very clearly he has a bright red tongue in the middle of his black, gaping maw. But I just love that turn of phrase. I love the face that Kermit makes when Sam says it to him. It is a great moment. It's perfect with Sam's over-the-top rhetoric and delivery. And it's exactly the kind of thing that I would say if I felt I could get away with it. Because I love Sam in this sketch and his righteous indignation, his failure to predict that he's being swindled. All of that is wonderful. But that phrase in particular is a hoot.
Ben, I have a question for you.
Yes.
That I know the answer to, but I need to have it on the record. You do not care for professional wrestling.
This is correct.
However, I think I know who your favorite wrestler would be.
George the Animal Steel?
No. I am now turning around my laptop to show Ben.
Because he had a blue tongue, right?
No, it was also green.
Okay.
It was a green tongue. But there is a wrestler for, at one point, WWE, who's going to be on the Chris Jericho cruise that I thought about going on, named...
Hornswoggle. That is a... You're not wrong, Pete. I would say that if I was likely to cast my fandom behind a wrestler, somebody named Hornswoggle would be somebody I would be incapable of not backing.
Yeah, Hornswoggle's great, man. He's awesome. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstMainBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, howls, boos, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
I don't know.
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 21, guest starring Bob Hope. Yay!